Good evening. A cop is fired in Kentucky, the anniversary of a double execution, and Juneteenth in New York City. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Friday, June 19th, 2020. And Louisville, Kentucky Mayor Greg Fisher said today he would fire Brett Hexen, one of three police officers to fire weapons on March 13th at the apartment of Breonna Taylor, killing her. Continuing protests since the shooting erupted in violence this morning as officers fired pepper balls into a crowd. And that was the sound of the pepper balls being fired. Hankison is accused of blindly firing 10 rounds into Taylor's apartment. The other two officers who fired their weapons, Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly and Officer Miles Cosgrove, remain on administrative assignment. The three officers were in plain clothes. They were executing a no-knock search warrant. No drugs were found, and postal inspectors had informed police there were no suspicious packages delivered to the home. A Louisville activist, Talisha Williams, spoke today on an online event sponsored by the Movement for Black Lives.
But here in Louisville, we are definitely taking initiatives on making sure that Breonna's voice is heard despite everything that has happened. Some of our demands include changing the narrative around police terrorism so that that can include the gun violence that is projected onto Black bodies. We are also demanding that the police officers who were involved with the murder of Breonna Taylor are fired, their pensions are taken away from them and convicted. Right now, the city is mourning. We're very emotional. There's so much happening. I'm so emotional right now, and I'm so thankful for this space that is being held right now. What we're asking for the rest of the world is continue to lift us up in whatever way you do that. And we're going to continue fighting this fight. We're going to continue training. We're going to continue to provide safety for people in the neighborhoods, on the front lines, people, and we're getting large numbers. There are people who have never been on the front lines. There are people who have never wanted to create change who are doing so now, which is so important for us here in Louisville, Kentucky, and then all around the world. We're trying to make sure that we don't sway from the narrative, that we don't give too much attention to the negative things that are going on, and that we definitely keep our focus on the government and the things and the changes that they need to make.
And that's Talisha Williams, a Louisville activist, speaking earlier today. Breonna Taylor, 26, was shot at least eight times and died in her hallway after officers returned gunfire from Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker. Walker says he fired one shot as police entered, hitting Mattingly in the leg because he thought they were intruders. Some of the 20 police bullets entered a neighboring apartment. And President Trump is preparing for tomorrow's big campaign rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who heads up Trump's coronavirus task force and the director of the Tulsa Health Department, have said they're concerned the event will make Tulsa a new hotspot for COVID-19 infections. But that hasn't stopped the president from claiming 1 million people have asked for tickets to get into his speech. The hall holds 19,000 people, and cases of the illness have been spiking in the state. Attendees will not be required to wear masks. Trump also threatened protesters. He said that they could be treated roughly, lumping together protesters, anarchists, agitators, looters, or lowlifes on his Twitter feed. One of Trump's favorite targets are Seattle-based activists, where officials have been putting up a wall surrounding the zone occupied by protesters after police evacuated a nearby police station house known as CHOP for Capitol Hill Occupy Protest. Today, Juneteenth, is the anniversary of a military order freeing slaves in Texas and demanding their equal treatment, and multiple marches were held in the Seattle area in and around the country as well. Trump had this to say on Fox News.
The governor of the state of Washington is weak and the mayor is weak. And what they're doing is setting a precedent that's never been set before in this country. And these people that are taking over this incredible piece of real estate are obviously very good at real estate, maybe better than I was, because they paid nothing. They just took it over. And the police are somehow told not to be there. I'm sure they'd do a good job if they were told to do a good job. I assume they're properly trained. But we would go in there if they want us in, and we will take it back very quickly. It should never be allowed to fester like it's festering right now. It's disgraceful to our country. It's a disgrace.
That's President Trump. June 19th shares another major event in American history. 67 years ago, a married couple from New York City, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, were executed as so-called atomic spies at Sing Sing Prison. The event, at the height of the period known as McCarthyism, was caused in large part by the work of a Manhattan attorney named Roy Cohen, a friend and mentor to the young Donald Trump. The orphaned Rosenberg children were raised by songwriter Abe Meerpol and his wife, granddaughter Ivy Meerpol, has produced an HBO documentary about Cohen. Her father, Michael Meerpol, a retired economics professor, spoke with WBAI today.
It's the anniversary of what I can say without fear of contradiction, a judicial murder. The government knew that my mother was innocent, took her as a hostage, and killed her when my father wouldn't talk. And they framed him for a capital crime when we know that he was a relatively low-level spy who was basically out of the loop at the time that whatever atomic information was passed to the Soviet Union. So this is something that our family lives with forever. And for many, many years, we've been fighting to rectify this. Not the least was an attempt to get President Obama to declare via proclamation that our mother was convicted falsely on false testimony and that she was never a spy. She was never given a code name. And that was very recently. We did that in November and December of 2016. Our family's never given up that fight, and we will continue to advocate for that story as long as we have breath. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, today is a wonderful day because not only is it a Juneteenth to remember, but the whole country seems to have wakened up to the incredible mistreatment of African Americans that has been part of American history. Finally, the image of that cop with his knee on George Floyd's neck woke up lots of white folks as well as black folks, and it's a wonderful thing to behold. My father, Abel Meerpol, wrote the song Strange Fruit. He would be incredibly pleased that the anger that he felt about lynching that caused him to write that song has finally permeated an awful lot of our fellow citizens. So this June 19th is a pretty special one for that reason.
Right. What was Roy Cohen's role in all this?
Roy Cohen actually very specifically coached the chief prosecution witness, David Greenglass. And initially, both he and his wife, and those were the only two people whose testimony was the reason our parents were found guilty, both of them, before the grand jury and before the FBI, denied that our mother had anything to do with anything. It wasn't until like a month before the trial when first Ruth Greenglass suddenly, amazingly, remembered that my mother Ethel had done all this typing. And Roy Cohn was the man who went to David Greenglass and looked him in the eye and said, either you change your testimony or you call your wife a liar. So he changed his testimony, and it was the typing that the prosecutor used on summation to make sure the jury would find my mother guilty. They found her guilty, and it was the typing that caused Judge Kaufman first to sentence her to death, and that caused President Eisenhower to deny clemency. And then David Greenglass admitted years later on 60 Minutes that he had lied and that he'd never seen my mother do any typing. As far as he was concerned, nobody did any typing.
Do you see a connection between Roy Cohen and those lies that he told to get this this conviction and the Trump administration today?
He taught Trump, never admit you're wrong. Respond with lies and distortion and gaslighting. Roy Cohen is an absolute master of gaslighting. Trump and his family were being sued for discrimination because they wouldn't rent to African Americans. And they attacked the government with a defamation lawsuit. Roy Cohn called the Justice Department Nazis and Ku Klux Klan. And the result was, of course, in the end, Trump settled a consent decree, didn't officially admit wrongdoing, but the consent decree forced him to never discriminate again, which, by the way, he'd violated anyway. Roy Cohn never paid his bills. Trump doesn't stiff people all the time. Roy Cohn was the one who put the bee in Trump's bonnet that he could go to Washington and get involved in national politics. The ghost of Roy Cohn's in the White House.
Looking back on it, do you wish that your parents had cooperated?
The point was that you don't partially confess to what you're accused of. The government would not have accepted the truth. They would have insisted on a full confession and put other people in the same position. And that was the thing my father wouldn't do. He was not about to, he had recruited some of his friends involved, and he wasn't about to put them in their position. And instead, in a kind of naive and rather sad way, he had faith in the American judicial system because he knew that half the case was built on a tissue of lies.
People might say, well, your parents helped the Soviet Union.
You just said plural, right?
Yeah.
My mother didn't do anything.
Let me take that question back. I didn't mean it that way. They would say that, let's say. But let's say you know, your dad helped the Soviet Union. That was a bad thing.
He helped the Soviet Union win World War II, which was a good thing.
Michael Mirpol, the son of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, executed today, 67 years ago. The atomic secrets alleged to have been given to the Soviet Union were minor. The details of making an atomic bomb are widely distributed in libraries around the world. There are currently nearly 14,000 nuclear weapons held by nine nations. And in the House of Representatives today, the portraits of four former speakers of the House who joined the Confederacy in the Civil War were removed on orders of the Democratic majority. In the Senate, Republicans blocked the move sponsored by Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey to remove statues of Confederate leaders on the Senate side of the Capitol. The movement to get rid of statues of historical figures known for racism and brutality has been sweeping the world. Earlier this month, the statue of Belgium's King Leopold was occupied and defaced. In Bristol, England, the statue of slave trader Edward Colston was dumped in the harbor. The author of the book, King Leopold's Ghost, is Adam Hochschild. He says there's nothing wrong with pulling down certain monuments.
It's correcting how history is remembered, because we think of statues as things which ought to be remembering people who should be celebrated for one reason or another. And I think there's good cause for asking, why should we be celebrating this king who not only invented a very brutal forced labor system, but saw that same forced labor system copied, because it was so lucrative, by other colonial regimes in Africa, French, German, and Portuguese colonies nearby who also had wild rubber, saw how much Leopold was making with this system of his, and began doing very similar things. So I think it's good that those statues are coming down.
What effect did that colonialism have on the Congo of today?
That history weighs very heavily on the country. I've been there a couple of times. I was there about a year ago. And it is a devastated land. And I think the history rests on it heavily in this way, that colonialism, everywhere it occurred, in Africa, or when the United States colonized the Philippines, or other examples all over the world, colonialism exists basically to enrich the mother country, the country that owns the colony involved. And so the experience that colonized peoples have of government is an organized system of plunder. And when that's your experience of government, it is very hard to quickly make a transition to democracy. And it's not surprising to me that a lot of previously colonized countries have had great troubles in doing so. The Congo was a particularly egregious example because independence came there very quickly in 1960. The country's first democratically chosen prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, was too radical for the United States and Belgium, and they helped engineer his overthrow and assassination. And then, with American support, Mobutu Sese Seko became dictator a couple of years later, reigned over the country for 32 years, amassed a fortune even larger than that of King Leopold. And there again was an example of government as an organized system of plunder. He finally was overthrown and died in 1997. But the Kabila dynasty, which has run the country most of the time since then, is not much better. Again, politicians who are really running a country as an enterprise to line their own pockets and those of their entourage and family. So I think the country is still struggling under the legacy of colonialism.
And just to sum up, though, it could be said that the West owes the Congo as well as other countries more than just a pull-down statue as far as reparations for the damage that was done.
Absolutely. I think there are big reparations that are owed. Exactly how to pay them is a complicated question, because when you've got a place that has such a dysfunctional government, you don't want to just, you know, pour billions of dollars in grants or loans to that government, because they're going to go into people's pockets. But I do think that there are things that can be done. There are ways in which you can do aid and development programs that reach the grassroots and help people. There are ways you can provide educational opportunities, and there are ways that you can ease some of the trade barriers that make it hard, for example, for African farmers to sell their crops in Europe or the United States.
Adam Hochschild is author of King Leopold's Ghost. Meanwhile, in Richmond, Virginia, where protesters have unseated at least four Confederate statues, a state court ruled that a large equestrian statue of Robert E. Lee must remain because of an agreement with a landowner more than a century ago that the city must affectionately protect the monument. In New York City, earlier this week, the Rent Guidelines Board voted a one-year rent freeze, followed by a 1% increase on the second part of a two-year lease. The reform heralded by the mayor has failed to impress some of New York City's council members. Helen Rosenthal represents the Upper West Side. She says with the end of the eviction moratorium looming and the state and city billions in the red, a disaster is brewing. The answer, she says, is simple. Tax Wall Street.
What's the one entity that has not gone through hell and back during COVID? It's Wall Street. And this would simply be collecting a tax on stock and bond sales. There are revenue solutions out there. I think we need more money infused into the system. I think that the state is facing a $13 billion shortfall. The city is facing a $10 billion shortfall. At least there's no reason that we should be forced to make serious, horrible cuts to the city's budget, to be not giving funding to tenants who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own and need to pay rent to stay in their home. We have to have more revenue in the system, and federal government has to step up, and until they do, the city should be allowed to borrow, and the state should allow the city and the state to share in the proceeds of the securities transfer tax.
All of this is well and good, but when the evictions start and people cannot prove they were, or don't know how to prove that they were impacted or didn't keep the right evidence, the idea of even bringing everybody together into the after August into the housing court is seems to be a COVID problem there, and that's what's been brought to me. But the other thing is also it's in itself would be a natural disaster. I mean, thousands of people risking.
There's no way. Correct. I agree with you 100%. And it is emotional. We're down to the last second, so. People are serious about change. We need to be demanding that the state do something about it. The city can't. It's not in our purview, nor do we have any money. And it's infuriating. It's very emotional. Are we ready? Is our homeless system ready to absorb the tens of thousands more people who will be made homeless by these evictions just because the federal government and the state fell through? I mean, it's outrageous.
If they don't do anything, who's going to enforce the evictions?
Going again to the reality next step, I think that's where the state and the city government has fallen down, is with the specifics. The logistics of exactly how things happen. And we're not thinking clearly enough and not planning for realities on the ground. It's egregious. I agree with you, and I'm as appalled as you are.
Obviously, there's not an easy answer.
There is an easy answer. There's a very easy answer. This is a revenue problem. It's a revenue problem for families who have lost their jobs and therefore can't pay their rent. Government came through for some families with unemployment insurance or a stimulus check, but they did not come through for the undocumented. The state could very simply unwind this rebate of the securities transfer tax.
What about the NYPD budget?
So last week, the New York City Council, through the speaker, the co-chairs of the BLAC, and Donovan Richards, who is chair of the Committee on Public Safety, issued a statement calling on the mayor to defund $1.1 billion out of the police budget. We have sent over to City Hall a route to that number that would include a combination of moving services from the responsibility of the NYPD back to the Department of Education or wherever, functions that should never have ever been in the purview of the NYPD, plus, so that's some restructuring, but plus cutting four classes so that we would not be replacing the officers who leave, in addition to cuts to overtime. It's the mayor's office that refuses to entertain these ideas, and it's outrageous.
New York City Council Member Helen Rosenthal. And finally, Juneteenth got its start in Texas when a union officer made an order freeing all slaves and declaring black people as equals. The holiday has been celebrated in Texas ever since, and many want to see it become a national holiday, America's second Independence Day. But New York City has its own version of freed blacks making their own way. A former free black town in what's now Central Park on the west side in the 80s called Seneca Village. Anthropologist Nan Rothschild from Columbia University was part of a dig that discovered remains of the settlement.
When we started to excavate, we had no idea whether we would really find significant deposits. We were really lucky because the first day that we started opening test units, we found a wall and then another wall. And we had found two walls of a house that had belonged to the Wilson family, William Godfrey Wilson, who lived in a small house. It was 20 by 20 feet, which sounds tiny by today's standards, but it was a clapboard house, and it was three stories tall. The Wilsons, with their nine children, lived in this house. He was the sexton of one of the churches in Seneca Village, All Angels Church, which was not far from the house. The house was on about 84th Street, and the church was on 85th Street, if you think about today's streets. In that house, we found a lot of material that showed how the Wilsons lived. In some ways, the most exciting artifact was a child's shoe, but we also found lots of dishes, and we found a toothbrush and a comb and belt buckles. And
was there slavery at the time? What was that? What was happening then?
Slavery had not quite formally ended. It ended in New York State in 1827. But everybody in this community was free. One of them had a parent who had been enslaved. But in 1820, New York State passed a law that said if you were black and you wanted to vote, you had to own property worth $250. So one of the appeals of the Seneca Village area was that the land was inexpensive because it was pretty far from the settled area of the city. All the people who lived in Seneca Village were either New Yorkers or came from adjacent states. And there were some Irish as well who came in the 1840s. Seneca Village started in the 1820s.
In a sense, this was a place that people went in order to establish themselves as regular citizens of New York without being surrounded by people who were a danger to them?
They found it to be a very pleasant place to live, and it was a self-sufficient community. The village extended from about 82nd to about 87th Street between what is now Central Park West and 7th Avenue. If, even when the Irish moved in, there's no evidence that we have found that there was any conflict between those two groups. And if you know anything about New York City during that time period, and in lower Manhattan, there was lots of conflict.
Why was such a beautiful copacetic community like this, that seemed to have gotten past all the horrors of gangs in New York time, dismantled?
Because the powers that be in New York City decided that New York should have a large grand park, like some of the parks in England and Europe. They looked around and they decided that the best place would be in what we now know as Central Park. So Seneca Village was one of the communities living there. It was the only really solid community there, but there were 1,500 other people living in what is now Central Park, and they were all displaced. People in Seneca Village evicted by right of eminent domain. Their houses were bought, but for very small sums.
What is the significance of this to New York on June 19th, Juneteenth?
It's incredibly significant. When we think of black people in New York in the 19th century, we think of either people who were free or enslaved. But this was a middle-class community. We don't think about class differences. We think, oh, all poor people, all black people in New York were poor. Well, these people may not have been affluent in terms of wealth, but they were really solidly middle class. It's a compelling story of how liberty has been achieved by African Americans, by how freedom has been achieved.
Anthropologist Nan Rothschild from Columbia University. And that's some of the news. And that's some of the news for Friday, June 19th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.